This meeting is now being recorded.
Apologies and your indulgence as we go back over so that this is all captured for those who are not able to join us in real time. My name is Joe Pateski. I'm a member of Cassini's flight team and your host for today's presentation of Cassini Charm. We're going to be looking at several different results from last year's dramatic discovery, confirmation of an ocean encircling the moon Enceladus under its icy surface. We have the authors of several seminal papers that were published in the last year from instruments that are not normally what we think of in response in terms of making dramatic discoveries. These are not cameras, but you'll hear about the evidence that these instruments were able to pull together and assess in order to find that there truly is an ocean. Our first speaker is Alexi Bouquet, who's currently a PhD student in a joint University of Texas at San Antonio Southwest Research Institute program, working with Cassini's ion and neutral mass spectrometer, which we call INMS, instrument team. Alexi started off with an engineering degree, followed by working at Airbus in their handling qualities and performance departments. As you can see, he's gone through a career change, having returned to school, first for a master's degree in astrophysics, space, and planetary science, prior to his coming from France to the United States. In addition to Cassini, he is involved with modeling work for the Mass Spectrometer for Planetary Exploration Instrument, also known as Mass Specs, which will be part of the science payload on the upcoming Europa mission.
Okay, looks like it's good. So, hello everyone. So first, I caught a cold, so I hope I'm not going to lose my voice mid-talk. So I'm going to be talking about some possible evidence for a source of methane in Enceladus Ocean. Some work I did between the University of Besançon and the University of Texas at San Antonio in the joint program with the Southwest Research Institute. So first, a few words about the situation at Enceladus. So we're interested in the volatiles that we see in the plumes of Enceladus. Enceladus has a liquid water ocean under 35 kilometers of ice or so. That's one of its most interesting features. The other very interesting features are the water vapor plumes that are projected into space and that we believe come from the ocean. That's the dominating understanding of it right now. So that's a great scientific opportunity because it means we get to sample a little bit of what's inside this ocean. Those water vapor plumes are not only water. They also contain a host of different volatiles, including carbon dioxide, methane, nitrogen or carbon monoxide. They have the same mass, they're pretty hard to differentiate, ammonia, and a few others. Those volatiles can tell us a lot about what's happening in this ocean and what has happened to Enceladus since it was formed. So first, how do we know? So as Joe was saying, I'm not working on images and cameras, but rather on a mass spectrometer. So we have our sampling of the plumes through the ion and neutral mass spectrometer of Cassini, that's known as INMS. As you can see on the right, it has those two openings on the right through which the sample, the gas, can enter the instrument. The instrument will divide the gas, will sort out the molecules by mass, and that's how we can get an idea of what is in those plumes. Of course, this requires the spacecraft to fly through the plumes, which it did on six several times. Those volatiles can tell us a lot about Enceladus. First, the conditions of formation of Enceladus, depending on the condition of pressure and temperature, you can have a different balance of volatiles. You can expect to know where the materials that form Enceladus could come from. And also, it can tell us, of course, a lot about what's happening inside the ocean right now. If something is produced, if something is destroyed. First, if you care about the origins, you have to wonder, how is the mixture we're seeing today representative of the original one? Lots of things could have changed in a few billion years. One of the factors that could influence this this balance of volatiles and make one more more common than another one when they were not that way at the start would be the trapping in clathrate hydrates. I'm going to call them clathrates from now on, shorter. So clathrates are a special kind of ice. It's an ice where gas molecules, that can be a lot of different volatiles, are trapped in water cages. You see an example on the right of a methane molecule trapped in a clathrate cage. So with it all red and white molecules are water, and in the middle you see the methane molecule that stabilizes the cage. The gas molecule is what allows this cage to exist. There are several types and structures, so different arrangements of the water molecule depending on the gas. And the formation of clathrates and their existence requires, of course, a lot of water, a low temperature, after all, it's a type of ice, and a high pressure. This, when you consider that you have an ocean on an icy satellite under kilometers of ice, those conditions are likely to be met at Enceladus. And actually, not only at Enceladus. Clathrates are potentially ubiquitous in the solar system, in the cryosphere of Mars, underground, among the frozen water, on Europa, for the same reason as Enceladus, a lot of ice, high pressure in the ocean, and it's a cold world. Titan also has an extensive cryosphere that could host clathrates. Pluto, of course, but also an interesting characteristic of clathrates that you could see them in comets. So I put here the image of 67P. Some of the volatiles that we're seeing being freed from 67P could come from a clathrate that has been hypothesized. Comets, of course, don't offer a very high pressure. The gravity is very low, and the comets are not that big. But they spend most of their time in a very cold environment, which is enough to make up for it. And when the comet comes closer to the sun periodically, it can be expected to heat up a bit, which would be enough to destabilize the clathrates, and they would release their volatiles, and that would account for some of the things we see from the data of the Rosetta mission. But that's an entirely different story. Of course, we're going to focus on how clathrates could form on Enceladus. And of course, as ubiquitous in the solar system, that includes Earth. Clathrates are present on Earth, which is not necessarily a good news. So methane clathrates are found in sediments in the ocean. Remember, high pressure and pretty low temperature. Here's an example of a funny thing we can do with methane clathrates, which are called pretty often methane ice. They can burn. Because if you approach a flame, you're going to melt a bit of the clathrate, it's going to release methane. Methane is flammable, and the flame will keep melting more clathrate and releasing more methane. So you can see ice burning on the right of the screen. I said it's not really good news because clathrate can be either formed nearly near their limit of stability. It can be easy to destabilize, so heating a little bit the ocean could destabilize them and release their gas, so release a lot of methane, which is a greenhouse gas effect. And we would end up with accelerating the global warming. That's the clathrate gun hypothesis. But let's come back to our idea of clathrates on Enceladus and the model we use to know what clathrates could do to Enceladus. So, we started from a subglacial lake model of clathrate formation that is aimed at representing how much of each species we trap in clathrate in the condition of a subglacial lake. So for the big word, it's a thermodynamic statistical model describing the gas clathrate interaction. What the model will do is you tell the model what volatiles you have in the water, and the model will tell you you trap that that proportion of, let's say, methane in the perforate, that proportion of CO2, so that will end up telling you how the balance of volatiles dissolved in the lake is going to change. This model has been applied to Vostok Lake, which is a subglacial lake in Antarctica, so on Earth. The volatiles in the case of Vostok were supplied by the melting of ice at the liquid-ice interface. We believe that it would work pretty much the same for Enceladus, as a lot of volatiles would be originally trapped in the ice, but over the course of time, because of the exchanges at the interface, they will end up filling the ocean up to the point clathrate will start forming and affecting the balance of volatiles in the ocean. So, okay, I promise this is my only text-only slide. What species among the ones we see in Enceladus could be trapped? So it's known experimentally what species are prone to being trapped. In Enceladus plants, that would be carbon dioxide, nitrogen, methane. I think you get by this point that methane is a pretty good guess for clathrates. Carbon monoxide, hydrogen sulfide. We also added a bit of work on the noble gases, because noble gases are a boon for solar system history. Since they don't react, they are not changed by reactions, you can use them as a tracer of where do materials come from. But of course, if their relative abundances are changed by trapping in clathrates, then that's a problem for reading the history of the solar system. So we needed to assess how they would be impacted too. But that part of the work took a backseat to what we found about methane. So, second question, of course, are the conditions met at Enceladus to actually form the clathrate and keep them existing? So this is a pressure-temperature graph. The yellow is the part where the clathrates can exist, or an hypothetical clathrate may hosting primarily the molecules seen in the plume. So yellow is the zone where it can exist, and blue is the domain of pressure we expect in the ocean. What we can infer from this graph is that below room temperature, 300 Kelvin, formation of stability clathrate is possible at Enceladus. Of course, Enceladus is not expected to be at room temperature. Most of the ocean would be pretty cold, around the freezing point of water, or even lower due to the presence of ammonia. So we're pretty safe in assuming that the conditions for formation are met at Enceladus. And now, what happens when we run the model? Plenty of things. So the one striking thing, the one that came up in every scenario I ran, was that no matter what, methane would be depleted compared to the other species. That's pretty big. So that means we shouldn't be seeing so much methane in the plumes. It should have been trapped in clathrates. So dotted or solid lines on this graph represent different kinds of clathrate structures. We expect we know which structure would preferentially form, but we wanted to cover all bases. But once the clathrates are formed, what happens to them? We calculated their density. It's lower than salt water. Clathrates would float. In a natural environment, clathrates are not even full, so they would be even lighter than that. There are some empty cages. So what would happen is that you would form clathrates near the ice-water interface, where it's colder, and they would ascend and become a part of the icy crust of Enceladus. The icy crust is much thicker than the ocean, so it can store quite a lot. Of course, you cannot exclude that some clathrates would be dragged along by whatever the process of formation of plumes are, and potentially they would enrich the plumes in the volatiles that are trapped. You cannot exclude that. However, given where the clathrates would preferentially form, we can expect that a lot of them would take their methane into the icy crust. So the possible explanations for the excess of methane, I already touched on one. Clathrates are being dragged along, ejected in big quantities, big enough that it noticeably impacts what we're seeing in the plume. Or the other is that there's a source of methane consistently adding methane and shifting the balance of the gases in the ocean towards more methane. And the source for that would be hydrothermal activity, just like the one we're seeing on Earth. Of course, this picture does not come from Enceladus. So just like we're seeing on Earth, there will be rock-water interactions and ulterior processes involving hydrogen produced by the sands that would lead to the production of methane. So when there are rock-water interactions, we expect to see hydrogen being produced first and foremost. Methane is not the biggest product. So the following question, of course, is do we see hydrogen in the plumes? Answer, yes, we do. INMS does detect hydrogen when it flies through the plumes. So that's pretty good news. Hydrogen is pretty interesting in that it's a tiny molecule, very light. It's not subject to trapping in clathrates. It's too small to stabilize the cages. And it can pretty much not be stored in Enceladus. It would have escaped. That means if we're seeing H2, it's being produced right now. It's not something that has been produced long ago and been stored and being released now. That's pretty good news, but the thing is, INMS sees more hydrogen when it flies faster. Yes, that's a bit weird. And the explanation is that when INMS flies through the plumes are not only gases, they are also ice grains. Ice grains will impact the instrument, and this instrument is made mostly of titanium. So the impact will release titanium, and this pure titanium can react with water. There's plenty of water available. We're flying through a water vapor plume. And the reaction between titanium and water will form hydrogen. So the hydrogen we are seeing in the instruments, we have no guarantee that it's not an artifact instead of being actually something from the plumes. So we detect a lot of H2, a lot of hydrogen, but we cannot be sure that all of it comes from the inside of Enceladus. There are some high stakes in trying to sort this hydrogen detection question out, because it's a smoking gun of hydrothermal activity. It would be, since it cannot be stored or trapped, it would be a direct estimate of how much hydrothermal activity is going on. Also, some authors have suggested that the ratio between hydrogen and methane could be indicative of life. Life is much better at producing methane than hydrothermal activity. However, this is still very controversial. We're still very far from being able to make an assessment. And as I explained earlier in the talk, the fact that methane can be trapped in a clathrate and that the formation of clathrate is very fast in a liquid medium, that would make the estimate of the methane quantity very difficult. So we are pretty far from a gotcha in this regard. So the takeaway points for today. First, the abundance of methane in the plume is in conflict with the fact that Enceladus is a great environment for forming clathrates. Methane should be trapped. However, we see a lot of it escaping. So either clathrates participated in the plumes, they were dissociated and released their gas, or hydrothermal activity is adding methane. The second takeaway point is that hydrogen is potentially a gold mine for characterizing hydrothermal activity, but its quantification is still elusive and still the subject of a lot of work. Well, thanks everyone for your attention, and I'll be taking questions if there are any. Thank you.
Thank you, Alexei. I have several questions, but first let me find out if anybody online has any questions for our first speaker. Well, I have to admit, so let me start with a couple questions. Alexei, I was wondering, when you talked about how hydrogen is detected in the INMS chamber, which then working backwards shows that it must have been water ice that had impacted the chamber. Was the titanium coating of the chamber initially selected with the intent of being able to make this type of detection? Or was this a happy coincidence?
No. First, the instrument is made of titanium, but titanium oxidizes very quickly in the presence of air, so the instrument is coated in titanium oxide, which is unreactive. So we were safe in that regard. There shouldn't be reactions happening. But when INMS was designed, it was aimed primarily at Titan. We did not know anything about Enceladus. The Voyager had shown that it was a tiny lump of ice. So it was not one of the primary targets of Cassini at all. Titan was all the rage at this point. Enceladus, the plumes were a surprise. So at no point was it expected that we would have to deal with this problem at Enceladus.
So some happy serendipity. Any questions online yet?
Yes, yes and no. It's happy because the impacts have allowed to determine the deuterium to hydrogen ratio at Enceladus, but also it really muddies the water when it comes to determining how much hydrogen we're actually seeing from Enceladus. So there is good news and bad news in that.
And a follow-up question to that, how is this result informing the design of the instrument that you and I'm guessing Hunter Waite are working on for the Europa mission? Of course, what you can say or can't say, given that this is only very early days.
Yes, I know this question is being discussed. First, the titanium is very unlikely to be selected this time. So the antechamber, as far as I know, the material of the antechamber of mass specs hasn't been decided yet, but it will be kept in mind that it must interact gracefully with ice grains, because we are hoping to see similar plumes at Europa. Also, the computing model that is being developed to account for those impacts in the antechamber, so for to model all the reactions happening in the antechamber of INMS, this model can be adapted and probably reused to predict what reactions could happen in the Europa instrument. So it's a good example of a lesson learned that will carry on to a future instrument.
This is Kathy Lowry in Louisville. How does the concentration of class rates on compare with what you find at Titan?
Excuse me, could you repeat the question, please?
How did the concentration of class rates that you found compare with what was found on Titan?
What do you mean? You mean the ratios of the guests in the class rates at Titan?
Were you finding more class rates on Titan or on Enceladus?
Go ahead. Well, I suspect one of the difficulties here is that in this particular case, CDA was, which is a direct detection instrument as opposed to something which is working as an imager. So because they were able to detect these actual class rates coming off of the surface of Enceladus or from the interior because of the plume, they were able to make this measurement in a way that would not be possible at Titan. because when we plan Titan science, for the most part, actually CDA tends to be a very minor player because we have, I don't know, actually I'm looking at Marcia Burton, who is one of our magnetosphere and plasma science scientists, and I'm wondering, is there any CDA results looking at this from Titan? I think the class rate work has been primarily models. I'm not sure how much has been done on Titan.
I'm sure there's no CDA data. I mean, typically when we're at low altitude, we articulate away and try and not get all jumped up. So the CDA guys that are online would probably have to answer that question, what's known about that. But typically we're not measuring.
So good question, Catherine, and one that we'd very much like to know the answer to, but it looks like we're going to need several instruments in order to establish that.
Thank you.
Yes, Frank. Frank Postberg from CDA. I don't think class rates have been observed at Titan at all. I mean, neither from INMS nor CDA. CDA doesn't assess the composition of the Titan atmosphere at all, as you were implying. But I don't think INMS has detected class rates, but INMS has probably detected methane in Titan's atmosphere, so you could possibly compare the methane abundance of Titan and Enceladus.
Thank you, Frank.
Yes, modeling class rates, class rate formation in a similar way as to Enceladus is totally within reach from a modeling point of view. However, for the data, to my knowledge, yes, there is no firm detection. So in the methane in Titan could be the object of a sort of cycle, and its current abundance not being something that will stay forever. There could have been several events in the history of Titan where methane was released, and class rates could have played a part in that. But on my end, the modeling work of Titan is still in its beginnings.
Any other questions for our speaker? All right, Alexi, thank you very much. And we are ready now to move on to our next speaker. We have an introduction. We have two speakers for our next presentation, so in alphabetical order. Sean Hsu, who is based at the Laboratory for Atmospheric and Space Physics at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He's a member of Cassini's Cosmic Dust Analyzer, or CDA, team. Sean received his PhD from the University of Heidelberg, where his thesis addressed dynamics of Jovian and Saturnian stream particles. His research interests include planetary rings, cosmic dust, planetary and cometary magnetospheres, and, of course, Enceladus. And I must say that the first time I heard him discussing this result was over NPR. Our other speaker on the same presentation is Frank Postberg, who I have not yet heard on NPR, who is a planetary scientist specializing in cosmic dust and outer solar system science. He is a professor in the Chemistry and Geosciences Department at the University of Heidelberg and a member of the scientific staff of the Cosmic Dust Research Group at Stuttgart University. Frank is a co-investigator for Cassini's Cosmic Dust Analyzer, CDA. I'm getting my instrument straight this time. In addition to being a co-investigator of the Surface Dust Analyzer, or SUMA, which is on NASA's upcoming Europa Multiple Flyby mission. Earlier in his career, he was a member of the Interstellar Preliminary Examination, ISPE, for the Stardust Sample Return Mission. Gentlemen, all yours.
Okay, hi. Can anyone hear me?
Yes.
Okay, so... Yeah, so this talk will be given by me and Professor Postberg, and so I will manage the talk and whenever if you have any questions for him or you have some thoughts like to share. So this is about a result published a year ago based on detecting CDA and nanometer particles and how they the story is how these particles are formed and what they can tell us about the material in service. So we have a few introductory slides showing the configuration of the Saturn system and its moons and the rings, where the Cassini flying through all around. It has passed through, of course, several close flyby of the moons, providing us a lot of great images as well as in situ measurements to provide us detailed information at the close environment. And in the panel at the top, you see the relative size of various moons, and you can see that it is rather difficult to find Cetus because it's actually not a huge body. So you can find at the slightly left-hand side next to a big yellow thing called Tethys. So instead it's rather small, but actually it sits in a very interesting position, as you can see in the below, that it is its orbital location coincides with the brightest part of a diffuse ring called Saturn's E-ring. So the E-ring is very diffuse, but it covers a wide span of space, covering from the orbit of Mimas about distance to of 3 Saturn radii to Saturn, and all the way to Titan, which is about 20 Saturn radii. And the brightest part located at Cetus, which makes people wondering if it is the source, or would it be the source of the diffuse E-ring? And this question was not answered until the Cassini mission. And some of the great images shown here is that you can see the at the upper right-hand side, you see the backward scattering light, that is, the Sun is behind Saturn, and the Cassini taking this beautiful mosaic showing the diffuse light from these micron-sized ice grains in the E-ring. And the brightest part, of course, the orbit of Cetus. And zooming to the left, you see that there's a bright part of the emitting dust fitting into these bright arcs of E-ring. And zooming in further, you see also backward scattering or crescent of the Cetus with jets composing a plume composed of several jets and also some star tracks behind, and all these bright stuff you see are actually dust or ice particles, and that's what the main task of CDA so we will cover in part of these, and that is actually provide us a good information about what beneath the plume of Cetus. Okay, so get back to the Cassini a little bit. Cassini has a nice suite of instruments. So it has the remote sensing package that covers a wide range of wavelengths. You can see them as various telescopes on board. Is that they can look very closely compared to the telescope Earth. So they provide unprecedentedly high spatial resolution and spectral information that can tell us a lot. And on the other hand, we have in situ measurements. That is, in situ means in its original place. That's, we have to fly there and take measurements there. So that's the major difference between astronomy and planetary science, is that we can get there and take very detailed study at the material right there. Okay, so you must have seen this image above from the cameras. So from the left, you have Cetus with several different terrans. You can see there are heavily cratered terrans on the upper middle part, and also there are some ridges at the lower left part, and below at the bottom part, you see the four parallel parallel structures called tiger stripes. And in the middle, you see the overlapping of infrared image of temperature on top of the optical image of a scale about 100 kilometer wide. And you can see that the tiger stripes actually right facing the location where you see the hot temperature is. And zooming in further, you see these structures actually very narrow, and these are where the particles emitting. And as you can see in the rightmost figure. So in the plume of Cetus, we have a lot of different materials. We have solid components, we have gas components. So while we don't have liquid, which cannot be stable in that condition. So the instrument of Cavour-Cassini, as you have already heard access, is that the IMS instrument will measure the gas component in the plume flame status. So mostly the gas is water vapor and also some primordial gas components like CO, like ammonia, like methane that has been imported. And so I will not address this further, but I would like to draw your attention to the solid component. So the plume dust, of course, they are seen in the images as you have seen that a lot. So those reflect the particles, micron size or bigger, that they are effectively reflecting or scattering sunlight, and they can form these nicely plume images if you look at them at the right geometry. Of course, it will be detected by the cosmic dust analyzer, and I will address that a bit later. And also during the plume flyby, a lot of Cassini instruments also detect them unexpectedly, and because of very high dust density, a very extreme condition there. And the plume of Enceladus, as we know it, is that it is the main source of the diffuse E-ring around Saturn. So let's take a closer look at the instrument, the cosmic dust analyzer. So you see the photo of the instrument, it has a shining gold color. The cylinder is about 50 centimeters in diameter, and that is an impact ionization dust detector. So what the working principle is that you have a piece of dust particles or any materials that are coming in, then eventually it will hit on the target of the instrument and with a few kilometers per second speed. And that kinetic energy will transfer into dissociation, fragmentation, and also ionization of the materials from the instrument target as well as the particle itself. So if I analyze these plasma components, we can separate with an electrode, and we can analyze the charge detected compared to the calibration in the laboratory experiment. We could provide a good constraint about their composition as well as their masses or size. So the composition information is acquired by a time of flight mass. So it's in the spectrometer, time of flight mass spectrometer, and it has a moderate spectral resolution, so it will provide us elementary composition information. Also, another important factor is how much plasma is produced from the dust impact. And from the lab, we know that the amount of plasma production as marked in the center yellow box is proportional to the dust mass times the velocity of impact to a very high power, 3.5 or even higher. That means with a wide range of impact speed or the spectral speed, we can actually cover a lot of particle sizes because that's within the instrument detection limits. So we can see micron size and slightly bigger particles, and we can see particles slightly smaller than that, and if these particles are really fast, we can even see nanometer particles. And the particle size in contrast to the composition, it provides us very important information about their dynamics, because those with different size will have different force operating on them are different. For example, for very large particle, you can imagine there's it's like a moon, so it will follow the gravitational force and without even feeling the magnetic field or radiation pressure. But for very tiny stuff, like nanometer particles, the electromagnetic force dominates, and their dynamics will be very different from the big ones, and actually will be quite a useful information. So let's take a look on the big particle first. So these are measurements made by CDA during Cassini's course in the E-ring. So on the top, you see two CDA time-of-flight mass spectrums showing two typical spectras for two different populations of E-ring ice grains. So majority of them are represented by the left figure, that is the sodium pool ice grain. So what you see here in the horizontal axis is mass of time as the heavier impact generated ions will take longer to reach the detector. That is how the time-flight mass spectrum works. So it takes us a series of mass as function of time, and you can see these forests of water clusters. That's from the impact cluster of ice grains. And in addition to that, you can also see a series of additional peak that is actually the sodium plus the water forming a cation that attach to, with the equal distance following the water cluster ions. And on the right, you see a very different looking spectra that is actually also a water ice particle, but is dominant, but the salt content is very high. So it's about 2% of the salt content. So that's slightly lower than the salt concentration. That's slightly higher than the salt concentration in Earth's ocean, but because sodium is very easy to ionize in the ionization process, that it shows a significant feature in the mass line of the time-flight spectrometer. And so these are actually the minor component, as people see in the E-ring, but the presence of these sodium-rich grains are actually significant because, as you can imagine, when the seawater in the Arctic region getting colder and colder, you start to freeze, you would not expect salt in the ice content. And to form these salty ice grains, that means you must have a direct water or liquid water source to provide the existence of these salty rich ice grains. And the other information we have is about their dynamics. So as you can see below, there's a simulation, dynamical evolution simulation of a particle of 1.4 micron radius starting from Enceladus. And so you can see their dynamical evolution time is rather long. It takes several years for their orbit to evolve due to the forces by the gravity, by the electromagnetic force, by the radiation pressure. And from here, what people can actually constrain what the amount of particle you need to replenish the loss of E-ring grains. And all these came into a picture like this. Okay, so at the right you see there's a schematic of the profile of Enceladus along its south polar region. So people expect, so from the gravitational measurements, people interpret there's a layer of liquid water beneath the south pole and in between the ice shell and the rocky core. And from there, the existence of salty water ice, salty ice grains provide us direct information that water is actually going right up to a near surface plume source where they could form while these bursting bubble scenarios. So you can imagine if you have gas in the dissolved water, as the pressure decreases, as like you open the can of soda, the gas starts to detach from the dissolved water content and forming bubbles, and it will eventually burst into and provide you these small particles or mixed particles, and with under low pressure, these will quick or fast freezing into these salt-rich particles that you see in the mass spectra. And these are actually heavier particles compared to those condensed or formed from the vapor condensation while these water vapor gas upwelling from the vent forming the plume of Enceladus. So we see a clear component or different dust components with different sizes and composition that tells us how these water or different types of water or ice grain form from the vents of the plume and how they compose the E-ring in their relative fractions in the E-ring. So these are for the bigger particles, for the bigger ice grains. What we can tell is the surface process or kind of the thermal what is that? It's the evolution of water surfacing basically how to say that. So it's a water surface exposing to almost vacuum and forming the gas column into the vent and forming these ice grains. So it's quite unique in the solar system, like as we have it. And now I would like to take your attention to a smaller part of the dust that we see. So these are called stream particles. So these are nanometer scale particles that are traveling with very high speed. So these types of particles, tiny and fast particles, first seen in the Jovian system, but they are predicted that can be also detected at the Saturn, which is the case, as you see in the bottom, that before Cassini even reached Saturn, the cosmic dust analyzer already start to look for materials coming from Saturn. So these tiny particles, the detection rate of these tiny particles get higher and higher as the spacecraft approaching to Saturn. As you can see, the horizontal axis is time of year in 2004. And the rate gets higher and higher as the spacecraft closing in. And also you see there are burst-like structures. So they are not like a continuous flux of particles, but they show the high fluctuate fluxes, which later is being found that is correlated with the solar wind conditions. And from the composition point of view, it's quite puzzling, actually, from the beginning, that we know Saturn's system, the moons, of the surface of the moons or the rings are actually made of water ice. The majority of them, or more than 90% of the surface, are water ice. However, its particles show a consistent silicon mass line that is probably the only particle constituent we can see from the from these particles. So the carbon peaks and the rhodium peak, while they are strong, they are most likely the surface. The target surface material, which is now originally from the particle. And the other thing to notice is that they are extremely metal poor. So they are silicon rich and they basically show none, if ever, any trace of metal, which is quite unique because in the normal rock forming materials, you know, these like tins or pyroxenes, they are all metal silicon oxide. So what we know is that these particles, because they are silicon-rich, they mostly rock-related process. They must form the rock-related process, but they are not typical rock-forming minerals, as I said. And from a dynamical point of view, their solar interactions and also their high speeds tell us that they must be very tiny. And from the interaction of these particles, we have done the simulation with these bluish sheets from Saturn. We simulate how they behave to the how they react to the changing of the solar wind magnitude situation. And from there, what can tell us is actually what are their kinetic energy and their sizes or the escape velocity. So showing on the upper plot is the probability based on derived based on those exercises of the particles sizes showing the horizontal axis as well as the speed where they escape the Saturnian system. And so you can see a belt covering from the wide range of about 2 nanometer to about 8 nanometer in size, in radius. And from here, what we can actually convert it via the conservation of energy law is that we know how much energy they could gain from the magnetosphere of Saturn if they charge positively. And from the plasma measurement in the magnetosphere, we know there's a region that grain would preferably charge positive, that's outside about 7 solar radii. And so while we can convert the kinetic energy derived from of these particles derived from the solar wind action to the to the starting position where these particles start to gain energy and escape from the Saturn. And so what we got is the red contour as shown in the bottom plot. It's the blue contour. And we also done the forward modeling, that is we're launching particles and from the E-ring region, and what we got is a similar pattern. What it tells us is that it's actually a broad region, so they are, what we see them is not from the single point source. So they are from the broad region of a broad region in Saturn's E-ring where the charge or the grand charge polarity is preferable for them to gain energy to escape. And we came up with one explanation of this. So actually, these particles are not directly from any of the source, but they are from the E-ring. So these particles is most likely are nano-phase silica inclusions embedded in the E-ring, in the micron-sized E-ring, and where after E-ring escape from the plume of inserted, the E-ring particle entering the orbit of Saturn and their dynamics, their orbits evolve as a function of time. And meanwhile, the plasma ions in the metasphere start to erode the E-ring ice particles. And there's a process called differential erosion, that is the silica particles are sputtering or erosion resistant much more than the water ice matrix around them. So at some point, the water ice will erode away, and these will these nanosilica particle, which is more stiff and sputtering resist, will be released and from the E-ring grain and start their own dynamical evolution. And eventually, if these particles are released in the region where the plasma environment allow them to charge to the right polarity to get positively charged, they could gain energy from the magnetosphere of Saturn and escape from the Saturnian system. And that explains how we see these particles and the origin of these particles. And of course, the origin of particles implied from here is that they are coming from the E-ring grain, where insert is the ultimate source of both E-ring ice grains as well as these nanosilica particles. So let's get a quick stop here if anyone have any questions about what I just said. If not, I will proceed. So right now we know they are nanosilica particles. We know they are from Enceladus, but what does that tell us? So we know they are nanophase silica, but at every dust source, they could form in a different way. So they could form from top-bottom, top-down process or bottom-up process. So top-down means, for example, process like fragmentations. You grind a bulk of silica into smaller and smaller particles. That's one way to form silica, to form nanoparticles. Or you can form them, build them from molecular by molecular attaching to each other and form them from the bottom-up process, like synthesis of colloids, as people widely know. And the other constraint we have is that actually these particles have a narrow size range. So they the other thing is that because they are inclusion in the E-ring grain, they must form before the grain, the ice grain in the E-ring before they enter in the plume. So they pre-exist in the source of the plume within the surface. So what we need to find is a process that could form a narrow size range of nanosilica particles within inserters. So we think fragmentation is less likely because you will, as shown in this artistic representation in the lower left, that fragmentation will always produce a broad range of sizes. And that is not consistent with what we saw. And from the industry and a lot of other studies, we know that to form a uniform sizes of nanoparticles, the best way is to build them up from the bottom. And one of the most likely process we think is from the hydrothermal reaction. So silica and water system is very unique. So as you all know that if you put sugar in coffee, in hot coffee, as the coffee gets colder and colder, some sugar, if you put in a lot, will precipitate into solid again. So the dissolved one, as the dissolved components of sugar will precipitate as long as the solubility at temperature is reached. The solubility is reached, is saturated at the temperature. So let's say have silica, but there's an intermediate stage that before they precipitate, they form a stable phase of nanocolloids. So these nanoparticles could form stably and actually because they are so tiny, they could suspend in the water, as you see in the middle figure, that the whitish, the milky color in the water are actually silica colloids forming from hydrothermal reactions. And if you have enough time and proper conditions, they will precipitate for much larger structures like precipitation. And so this process, the kinetic of silica nanoparticle formation, has recently been well studied in the lab as well as theory. And we all have been, from the terrestrial studies and also some things on Mars, we know that silica is indeed an indication of hydrothermal reactions on Earth and Mars, on the terrestrial planets. So, and in this case, actually, these silica particles are very useful to provide the conditions within inserters, because it's not really, there's only a certain range of conditions they could form and exist stably. So one of them, what we can constrain is the pH, is the alkalinity or acidity of the subsurface water inserters. So this plot shows how stable these silica colloid is as function of pH, shown at the horizontal axis. So you can see that silica is stable at pH above 7 to about 10, closing to 11. So in this range, these colloid silica particles are charged negatively on the surface. So they can repel each other, not forming big aggregate aggregate and form large particles and precipitate. And there's a metastable region at about pH of 2, and I think that's not in the case we have here, as the salt-rich particles also infer the plume salt have a alkaline pH range. So this is concerned with the measurements of the big grain. And the other thing one can constrain and can be compared to the larger salt-rich particle measurement is that silica particle will lose their, or silica colloids particles in the solution will lose their negative charge because if you put too much salt in it. So this cation from the salt will attach to the negative charging side on the particles and they'll lose their charge and much easier to form, aggregation will perform much easily with a lot of salt. So to have individual nanosilica particles from the lab, we know that their salinity salt concentration shouldn't be higher than 4%. And this is actually a very important conclusion because this rule out that that they would form from a much earlier phase, because as you imagine, the cooling of the abstract eventually leads the solution into a brine phase, that you have a very high concentration of salt in your solution. And nanosilica will not survive that kind of condition, means that these particles we observe must be produced recently in a geological scale term. And another thing that's very important and it will take some time to explain is that we can actually constrain what is the rock composition to form these silica particles. So in this figure on the left, you see a modeled silica concentration, modeled and measured silica concentration as function of temperature and pH values. So for different rock materials, the solid line represents the silicon-rich rock in the experiment, and at different pH, shows to be green, blue, and black as pH 10, 8, 9, or 8, so alkaline pH, the relevant ones. And with the silica, poor cases shown in the dashed line. And with the circle, the black and the gray ones are from the experiments, the long-term hydrothermal experiments carried out by our Japanese colleague from University of Tokyo. So Professor Sakina and his team has performed this long-term hydrothermal experiments. So they put rock powders or different kinds into solutions of different pH and cook them at high pressure compared to the insulated interior for months. Measure what's left in the end and in the middle of the experiment, and from there it actually provides very good constraint about what we a very good complement to the observation of CDA. So you can see that also the horizontal dashed lines of green, blue, and black are the solubility of silica at 0 degree with respect to the temperature at the source of the room at different pH. So you can see that only with experiments of silicon-rich rock composition, you can produce silica solution, silica concentration high enough to form nanosilica. So the silica concentration must be above the solubility of silica at 0 degree to form nanophase silica. So this silicon-rich material or a rock is representing a primitive type of rock. It's not like a differentiated case like Earth's mantle, and that's actually tells us the core of insert is actually not highly differentiated and it's most likely porous. And also in the experiments they also find nanophase silica after they extract the solutions from the experiments, so and the size is perfectly matching what we see or what we inferred from the CDA measurements. Okay, so moving on, we can also provide some constraints on the temperature of the reaction. As you remember from the previous figure, that everything depends on temperature. So if you want to dissolve more silica, you need to have higher temperature. So what we can do is to provide a lower limit constraint on the temperature, but that is also complicated by the fact that the change of the pH will lead to change of the solubility of silica, and therefore we must consider both factors in this case. So we also come up with two scenarios that the first one, the two scenarios, the disequilibrium and equilibrium scenarios. And that refers to if the hydrothermal fluid is in chemical equilibrium with the ocean water surrounded. So for example, the Earth case, the hydrothermal vent systems in the Earth ocean are disequilibrium cases, like the chemical property and composition of the hydrothermal fluids is very different from the ocean water. And in that case, if we look at the right figure, what we can do is to derive a minimum temperature for a given pH, the alkalinity of the hydrothermal fluid and the seawater. So if we assume a pH of 9, and in this case, if the hydrothermal fluid is not in equilibrium with the seawater, the pH must drop upon cooling, meaning that, for example, if this drops from 9 to 8.5, which nanosilica can still stably survive, you need a temperature of 140 degrees Celsius. And if it is the case that the hydrothermal fluid in the ocean and icy crust actually are close to chemical equilibrium as a lower case, then we will expect the water composition or the subsurface water composition of the inserters is actually governed by the rock-rock interactions. So that is a whole closed system that the water and rock is kind of well mixed into equilibrium conditions, and what we see in the plume is reflect actually the subsurface ocean composition. And in that case, when the hydrothermal fluid cools, the pH might rise. Most likely it will rise. So for example, if you have a find the blue curve, light blue curve of pH 9, that is the hydrothermal fluid pH, and once it cools down to pH 10, it will require even higher temperature because higher pH values will the silica solubility is much higher to reach saturation. You need higher temperature to dissolve much more silica. Okay, and last constraint can provide is the stability over time. As you can imagine, these nanoparticles will not be very, very stable over time. So from lab experience, we know that these colloid particles in the solution formed initially with a radius of 2 to 4 nanometer. And then they will grow slowly. If they put in the right favorable condition, they will grow slowly by Ostwald ripening. And Ostwald ripening is actually a daily phenomenon. You can see if you put oil and water together, you'll see that oil particles or patches growing bigger and bigger by absorbing smaller oil particles. And that's a similar phenomenon for nanoparticle as well. So this process we can actually quantify and provide a constraint on how fast they will grow into sizes that we don't observe. So for the size range we observed, so smaller than 10 nanometer, they most likely form very recently if the Ostwald ripening is in process. So within 1 year, they must have formed from the saturated solution and then transport upwards to the Ewing grain. So this also implies a very fast upward motion, so to transport them from the bottom of the sea to the subsurface or to the plume of inserters. So that's about 50 to 70 kilometer in distance vertically from the vertically. So that's actually a very vicious convection. So also this will mean these fast convection will mean that most likely this will provide a quite good mixing of the seawater and the ocean water and the ice crust and also the core beneath. And so it's likely to be a rather equilibrium than disequilibrium conditions for the hydrothermal waters in the ocean. So to summarize, this is it's a figure that shows what we could derive from these nanoparticles as well as from the pure ion. So I don't want to repeat all these, but what I want to address is that these different population of particles actually reflect process at different depths of temperature within inserters. So the larger micron-sized ice grains reflect the thermodynamics of water interaction with chamber walls and forming ice grains of different composition near the plume, near the surface, while the silicon or nanosilica dust particles reflect more rock-related process that connects the porous core to the subsurface ocean and all the way up to the plume. So I would also like to show you some of the terrestrial analog that, as you may know, most of the hydrothermal vents we found on Earth are not this kind of alkaline hydrothermal vents. They are more with very low pH, so acidic, and with a lot of sulfur and depositions showing yellow colors. But we do find some particular case. The most famous one, or probably the only one, is the LOX CT systems that found only recently, within 2 decades. So it's very similar conditions to Enceladus. So it has high pH and it's not sit right on the mid-ocean ridge. And it has been, it suggests that it's been active for more than 10,000 years. And also there are some other cases, and also that these conditions more probable in the early oceans of on Earth. So these are some analogs, and that brings us to some probably most interesting question, is that these alkaline hydrothermal vents can actually support an ecosystem without sunlight. So how they support it is by production of H2, as mentioned in previous talk, from serpentinization. So these chemical reaction, the H2 provided from this chemical reaction will provide the microbes, if any, to survive the condition without sunlight and thrive for ecosystem down there. And this kind of system was considered to be a good candidate for life, where life first emerged on Earth, or could be any other places in the solar system or in the universe. Okay, so lastly, I would like to address that this work is following a concept proposed by Professor Eberhard Grund of dust astronomy, that we are using dust as not people used to think of, that we are using them as a tool like photons in the astronomy to detect the conditions at their source, which there's no other ways which cannot be told otherwise. So, as the exploration of planetary systems continues, we're certainly like to apply this approach further to other interesting systems like Io, Europa, Triton, other deep worlds. And with that, that's it. I'm happy to take any questions, and we are happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Sean. Any questions first from the virtual room? I did have a question about, especially the last slide, because always I'm curious about the astrobiology implications. And when you say going out to Io and Europa and then further out to Triton, how far do you imagine we could really push this kind of model going out in distance from the sun?
Well, so this will most likely not really depends on the distance of the sun, but I mean the solid phase of materials, which could have very different interactions and process compared to others like gas and plasma. So that will reveal us some unique opportunity to probe different processes and as sealed in the solid component of the system. And I think that's the tool we have, is how to analyze these particles, and combined with knowledge from the planetary science, we could we could apply it anywhere.
So may I add something? So of course in this case, the application of the dust astronomy has astrobiology implications for astrobiology, but because we are possibly probing a habitat, or at least a place where the conditions look like they could be habitable. But of course, that's just astronomically applied also outside the astrobiology, and this is what the last bullet implies, that it has a lot of applications.
Could you please explain the word serpentization?
So,
okay, so serpentinization, that's an exothermic rock-water interaction. You have primordial rock, or rock that has never seen water, which is water-free, encounters water, then it is an exothermic reaction starts, which produces hydrogen and energy. And this is happening on hydrothermal vents on Earth, and they provide nutrition and energy to the microbes, for example. So that's why it's relevant. And it's also, in the case of Enceladus, it could contribute to the overall energy budget of the Moon. Because, as you know, there's a lot of heat radiated away from the Moon, and some people are still struggling to find a mechanism which can produce all this energy. And subsidization could contribute here.
Any other questions for our speakers? All right, we're getting close to the end of our time, so I'd like to thank everybody very much for attending, and I'd like to thank our speakers again very much for participating. Our next CHARM telecon will be in 3 months with a speaker yet to be determined. Thanks all very much. We always appreciate your participation.
Thanks.
Thank you.